transparencies on the overhead projector. But in any case, please resume your seats. We need to begin. So, then I'm going to begin introducing the next speaker, Professor Dr. Yes, Nathan, yes. I just wanted to make sure I had the right one. Okay, yes. Professor Dr. Nathan Jastrom, he was, you may know, because many of you do know Nathan, he was born in Japan, where his father was serving as a missionary, so his earliest years were spent in Japan. I don't know if he studied any martial arts, but I'm not going to disagree with him on anything. He attended the University of South Dakota, where he graduated with a degree in classical languages. He then reached the pinnacle of his academic career as he came to Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne to concentrate in exegetical theology. As a logical consequence, he proceeded to the Graduate School of Harvard University, where his doctor father was Frank Moore Cross, and he received a doctorate on the basis of a thesis which he prepared on the Dead Sea Scroll of the Book of Numbers, on the basis of which he will be speaking today, on the basis of which he has already published an article in Texts in the Judean Desert. And there is a book which is now in the final stages leading to publication as a volume in the series Discoveries in the Judean Desert. He has been serving since 1990 as assistant professor of theology in Concordia University in River Forest, fulfilling indeed specifically that highest of all callings, the teaching of Hebrew and Old Testament theology. Professor Jastrom.
Thank you, Professor Yudish. I never know whether to thank or to curse my earlier teachers. They started me on this topic of doing research in the Old Testament, and once you get into it, you have to keep studying your whole life because you never can learn it as well as you should. So ever since I've been studying with Dr. Yudish, I've continued my study in the Old Testament. Specifically, I've been captivated by the Dead Sea Scrolls. It wasn't always that way. I thought that at first they were fairly dry pieces of dusty old manuscripts without much to tell us. But the more I got into work in the scrolls, the more interesting they have become. I was inaugurated into the realm of those people who work directly with the scrolls through my professor at Harvard, Frank Moore Cross, who had received the authority to publish these scrolls. And he had been then asking some of his students to help him with getting them out into print so that there would be less furor in the press. We didn't completely avoid that furor, but many of those texts are now in the final processes of editing. So I began to work with this scroll of the Book of Numbers in 1988, and then in 1989 went to Jerusalem to work with the fragments themselves during the summer months. And now it's, as was said, in the final processes of being published. Let me just give you some pictorial information from the Book of Numbers, the scroll that I worked with, 4Q Numbers B. First, the name 4Q means it's in the fourth cave, that mother lode of manuscripts. 4Q Numbers, it's the Book of Numbers, and B, it's the second one from that cave. There was a scroll, Leviticus Numbers A, as well. How much of the Book of Numbers Do we have, here's a drawing on a reduced scale of the fragments and the columns that we have preserved. You see that it's quite fragmentary. In fact, if you know the acronym for Dead Sea Scrolls, it's often in the literature as DSS, and some of us like to think of that as devilishly small scraps. But notice also how they're distributed. They are well spattered throughout the entire last half of the book of Numbers. And that distribution gives us a tremendous amount of information. We'll come back to this in a little bit. But this is the last column of the scroll. We do have something from that last column. And this is about one-third of the way through the scroll. You can see that most of the columns from this point on, in fact, all the columns from that point on, have at least one little fragment within the column. This is a rare sight, a color picture of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it's also rare because, well, it shows you something very significant about this particular scroll. Some of the lines were written in with red ink, something very unusual. It's been found in a couple other places, but this is the best example of a scroll with some lines in red ink. We think they may begin pericopes, be their form of the lectionary. They know where to start their reading. Well, I won't go through and read these, but some of you who have had Hebrew recently can perhaps make out this lamor up here saying, and down here, most of the word vayomer, and he said. This is another one of those same sorts of fragments. Again, a nice line of red writing up here. Again, you see the word vayomer. Even students who have not studied their Hebrew recently can remember that word. It comes out all over. See this little red mark down here? That's the beginning of a red line on the next column. And indeed, one of these fragments from this other sheet, I can't superimpose them, but one of them ended up fitting right on that little corner there. So it's exciting to work with these and finally figure out where they go and then see that they fit together in a very convincing way. Now this, you'll have to excuse a little bit how it came out as it went on the transparency. But this transparency shows how many of the columns of the book of Numbers we have. Out of the entire book, there would have been about 48 columns, and we have preserved of that, at least partially, 56%. So again, you see that it gives us a fairly large amount of information about the book of Numbers. If you chart how many actual words are preserved on the scroll, only that first portion are preserved, approximately 10%. Those are the letters, the words that we can actually see on the fragment itself. But because we can reconstruct the lines right around those words, we can fairly closely reconstruct, about another 30% or so of the text of Numbers. When you have a fragment that just gives you the middle word of five lines, and it's very narrow, you can still reconstruct what the lines must have been like on either side of that in order for it to fit in a normal column. So that's the sort of information we get, we can get fairly close reconstruction for about another 30%. And then putting all that information together, I can tell you the probable readings in much of the Book of Numbers. We know what type of manuscript it was. We know what family it belongs to. We know what type of spelling it used. So even from portions that haven't been preserved at all, we can make some sort of guess about the type of manuscript that this reflects. In other words, it ends up affecting the entire book. That's about the extent of the scroll. You have some idea of how much information is contained there. But more important than extent of scroll is its content. What do the words actually teach us about the text of Numbers itself? And here we have to begin speaking about textual criticism. And I know that there are different opinions on the validity of textual criticism, especially when applied to the Old Testament. We've heard some analysis of the layers of text that are possibly there according to certain theories. What I would like to do is discuss a little bit about the validity of textual criticism, even in the Old Testament, and then go from there and analyze some of the readings that we do have. First, we can say that the Book of Numbers that this scroll represents is very full of variants. Now that can do two things to you. It can make you very happy, or it can be a big nuisance. It all depends on how you consider textual criticism. If you believe that the received text is completely accurate, then they're just a nuisance, these variants. But if you have any doubt at all about the textual form of the received text, it's extremely exciting to have ancient variants with which to compare that received text. Now, some have lived with the belief that I believe is expressed very well by Dr. John Drickamer. I read something that he wrote recently, and he said it so succinctly, I'd just like to read what he read. He's writing from the perspective of a man who accepts inerrancy of the text. His advice is, the best course for those who take the Bible seriously is to refuse to observe the inane rules of modern textual criticism. We should stick with the common text, also called the textus receptus, the accepted text, and not worry. On the other hand, even the textus receptus preserves clear evidence that some of its text has suffered in transmission. You just can't deny that there's been some problem as scribes copied manuscript to manuscript. We have the actual variants in the received manuscripts from the medieval ages, and those have been collated by various scholars. We have the Masoretic Ketuv Kareh tradition that's in those Masoretic texts. And we also have the Talmudic tradition that at one point in time the rabbis brought together three very good scrolls, and any time there was a variant, they would choose the majority reading. So all of these pieces of evidence tell us that the Masoretic text has at least some problems that have crept into it as it's been transmitted from century to century. If textual criticism is disdained in favor of the received text, then I believe that the doctrine of inspiration is distorted. If you elevate the received text and say that that is the text that's inspired and inerrant, then it seems to me that you're calling the community of believers the inspired writers rather than the original author. Pieper in our Dogmatics textbook has said, we have never held that copyists of the holy writings were inspired. In fact, he takes great exception to the Roman Catholic Church for declaring that the Vulgate is the canonical text and is absolutely authoritative. It seems to me that the doctrine of inspiration says that it's the original autograph written by the prophet that is inspired. And therefore, it seems to me that the closer we can get to that original text, the closer we get to what we consider to be the inspired text. Now, when I say closer to the autograph, that doesn't necessarily mean closer chronologically. Consider this worst-case scenario. Let's say you have an autograph written by a prophet, and right after he wrote it, two scribes copying it. One scribe introduces all sorts of, we call them textual errors, even if he doesn't say anything wrong, he just says it differently. So one scribe produces a text that's quite a bit different. Another scribe is like a photocopy machine. The first scroll gets thrown into a cave, and we don't hear about it for thousands of years. The next one that's like a photocopy is copied again hundreds of times throughout years, year after year, but every time very accurately. Later on, archaeologists go and dig up this old scroll and they say, we have a scroll from the time of the prophet. And they compare it with what they have that was written, say, last year, and they notice differences. Now, which text is closer to the autograph? Well, actually, the one that had been copied better. That's the worst case scenario that says chronology doesn't necessarily bring you back closer, but it might. Actually, as most scholars work with these texts, they do say chronology is important, but it's not the major determining factor. You have both chronology and analysis of readings to see which reading is more likely original. Now, in that connection, take a look at how valuable this text of Numbers is, chronologically speaking. Start up here with BHS, I think published 1977, at least in a revised form. I think 1990 was another revision. But in years before present, it's just a little dot. Okay? Then we go back to the great edition of Kennicott, which was published around the time of our independence, 1776. That takes you back a long ways, but still not very far. That collates all of these medieval manuscripts, and I just give them numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, just to indicate we have thousands of medieval manuscripts. Notice that all of them, though, get us back to only about here on the timeline. The Leningrad Codex is much more significant, brings us back all the way, well, back to here, and it's a complete codex, so it's very helpful, and it's what BHS is based on. Some of the other early codices bring us back all the way back to here, but that's the earliest we can get back before we discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now suddenly, in one leap, the book of 4Q Numbers B has brought us way back this far. I mean, consider how much closer that is to the time of Moses, and you see chronologically this book is extremely old. It brings us back, it cuts the distance down in half. If you think of these scribes as introducing errors year after year, if you can cut out half of the years that they've been producing those errors, then there's a chance that the text that you have left has been preserved from some of the errors that could have crept into the text. Let's then talk about those, the readings that this scroll gives us. First, how it agrees with other manuscripts that we had known before this time. Look at that nice, well-divided pie. I mean, if you had a child, if you have families dividing pies, this would almost gain the approval of everybody in the family. Everybody gets an even share. But it makes textual critics pull out their hair, because what it says is, it seems like this manuscript is related to everything else we know in about equal fashion. Where does it fall? How can we characterize this manuscript? What family does it fit into? Very difficult to tell. from counting the different variants. See, it's unique 20% of the time. That's the first part. It agrees with the Masoretic text 26% of the time, agrees with the Samaritan Pentateuch 30% of the time, and it agrees with the Septuagint 25% of the time. Its readings are spread out all over the place. Here's a graph which takes all the times when one of these witnesses disagrees with another one and says, wherever there's a disagreement, how many times do you have just one manuscript against all the others? That is, how many times does each of these have unique readings in these variants? Again, if you count the variants, the 4Q numbers B has unique readings 35% of the time. Masoretic text has unique readings 19%, Samaritan Pentateuch 15%, Septuagint 31%. So again, you have counted readings, you don't get clear patterns. It seems like they're all kind of related, and yet they're all kind of unique at the same time. That's not what textual critics like to see if they're trying to group these manuscripts. What's more important than just counting the different types of readings is to start evaluating the readings. Once you start evaluating them for type, are they simply divergent readings? That is, do they say things using a different grammatical construction, using a synonym? Are they different in some way that's not longer or shorter? That's one type of reading. Another is, are they longer? Have they added words, or rather, are they shorter? Are they shorter? So those are the different types of readings you can have in these variants. You start analyzing those types, and then you start analyzing which one might be more original. And once you start doing that analysis, you get a little better picture of the classification of this manuscript. For instance, wherever 4Q numbers B has a unique reading, it is divergent almost half the time, it's longer almost half the time, and just a very short amount of times is it shorter. So right away from that, you get the idea that this manuscript is one that adds words more often than it takes words out. It's a full manuscript. That analysis is brought forth also by this next transparency. Wherever the other three texts are agreed in a reading, the Masoretic text, the Samaritan Pentateuch, the Septuagint, against a unique reading from 4Q numbers B, 4Q numbers B has a divergent reading 31% of the time, but 69% of the time, 4Q numbers B has a longer reading. 4Q numbers B then is an expansionistic text. It has more there than you find in other manuscripts. Let's then take you through just a few of the major categories that we can find of these readings. We'll start with the least major, in other words, the most minor, and that's where 4Q numbers B is shorter. 4Q numbers B is, when it's shorter, this is the only major pattern, this is the only pattern that appears. It's a minor pattern, but it's the only pattern that appears with short readings in 4Q numbers B. It can agree with the Masoretic text and Samaritan Pentateuch against the longer Septuagint. And when it does that, 100% of the time, its reading is probably original. That means that the Septuagint has added some secondary readings that the other texts don't have. That's what we can learn from that particular graph. Next, we go to divergent readings. This is far more major than the shorter readings. When 4Q numbers B has a different reading, how do those different readings tally up in terms of other manuscripts? You see again many pieces of the pie showing different ways it tallies up. I won't even read all these off to you because they just get very confusing. We're counting agreements. We're not analyzing how important those agreements are here, and it just gets confusing. The one thing I will say is that wherever you have the Masoretic text agreeing with 4Q numbers B, the readings tend to be original. And where you have the Masoretic text on the other side of the equation, 4Q numbers B readings tend to be secondary. That's important, because what it means is that 4Q numbers B agrees with the Samaritan Pentateuch and the Septuagint in many cases where they have common errors. There must be some sort of relationship between those texts then, a greater relationship than they have with the Masoretic text. And to illustrate that, this is that first category where you have 4Q numbers B agreeing with the Masoretic text. When it does that, most of its readings are original. At least that's a possible analysis. Anytime you talk about original readings or secondary readings, you end up using subjective criteria. Different scholars can disagree. We're talking about probabilities, not certainties. But it seems as though the readings that 4Q numbers B shares with the Masoretic text are original. Therefore, that tells less about their relationship. It's when they share errors that you really get a good idea of their relationship. And here's a transparency. Oh, I'm sorry, wrong one. Here's another major pattern with 4Q numbers B. When it agrees with the Samaritan Pentateuch and the Septuagint against the Masoretic text, sometimes it may be original. Those three witnesses may preserve a better reading than the Masoretic text. Sometimes it might be undecided, but quite often it's secondary. In other words, they share some significant secondary readings. Now, these are the last couple of pie charts that you'll see in case you're all pied out. The most significant patterns of agreement are where 4Q numbers B has the longer readings. And one of the reasons they're more significant is because longer readings are generally thought to be less likely to be original. One of the rules of textual criticism, the shorter reading should be preferred. So where you have longer readings, they're more likely secondary. If they're secondary, they can tell you more about relationships. Do you share this same mistake that another manuscript had? Well, you can see that 4Q numbers B shares longer readings with Samuel against the Masoretic text and the Septuagint. The number of those agreements is 10 within the manuscript. And of those, Q might be original 10%, but it's most likely secondary 90%. This then is like the major pattern that establishes the relationship between these manuscripts. 4Q Numbers B has to be related somehow to the Samaritan Pentateuch. And in fact, you see that the Septuagint also falls in that same category to a slightly lesser extent, in this category where you have those three agreeing in longer readings against the Masoretic text. You have secondary readings in 40% of the cases. So it seems clear that we do have, as was mentioned before, perhaps two editions of the Book of Numbers. One, a shorter edition preserved in the Masoretic text. The other, a longer edition known previously from the Samaritan Pentateuch, but now also from this Book of Numbers from Qumran. Those major editions that are in the Samaritan Pentateuch as well as in this text are blocked out in green here on this overlay. All of the green sections aren't in the Masoretic text, but you can see that some of them are preserved on the fragments, and some of them have to be reconstructed there for the columns to come out right. So it's pretty clear that 4Q Numbers B had all of the long editions of the Samaritan Pentateuch. And what these editions are, they aren't just new compositions where a scribe says, let's write some Bible today. While I was doing my dissertation, I did take bribes from my classmates. Do you want your name in? I have to write some Bible today. Rather, these are parts of Deuteronomy that are parallel to the Book of Numbers. And what we have here is like what we read during the season of Lent. They are harmonized texts. So we have the harmonized readings of how Jesus died. Here's a harmonized reading of how, say, Moses and the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. Now, all of these are in the book of, in the Samaritan Pentateuch, except this huge one right at the end. You might tell me, well, from the looks of it, it wasn't in your scroll either. It's in the blank space, right? But that blank space has to be filled in. And that's where I got to write some of the Bible. I got to make up what might have been in that section there that I knew had to be there. And it turns out that in the last chapter of Numbers, they're talking about women inheriting Zelophehad's daughters. They had talked about that already once before in chapter 27. And if you combine the two accounts so that the account in 36 includes a rehash of what goes on in 27, you end up with just the right amount of material. So I said, that must be what they had, and who's going to argue with me, right? Well, no one could prove me wrong, so they let me graduate. And then in a conference a year later, another text came to light where now we have a parabiblical document, a paraphrase, which also clearly combines chapter 27 and 36. So what starts out as a wild guess in an effort to fill a space now is confirmed by another manuscript. We do know that some manuscripts did combine these two chapters. Let's skip right to some conclusions then. What are some of the major conclusions we come to after looking at Dead Sea Scrolls in general and this scroll in particular? I think the primary conclusion that can often get lost in the midst of scholarly discussion about this variant or that, the primary conclusion is how carefully the text has been transmitted for thousands of years. Many scholars had thought if we dug up a text that cut our distance to the time of composition in half or even less, that we'd have vastly different texts that in some cases might be hard to recognize. What we find instead is that we can dig up these fragments, many of them size of a dime, find a few letters on them, and using concordances based on the Masoretic text, we can often place those fragments properly. Incredible accuracy. Even in this text, which is one of the most different, there's still a tremendous correspondence in what is actually placed in the text. A second conclusion that I think we're led to is that now we have more evidence to start practicing textual criticism also on the old. We've always been able to do it with the new because we've had thousands of manuscripts there and we're used to working with that sort of textual apparatus. Now we're beginning to get to the place where we can start to do it with the Old Testament. It's like a triangulation. It's always easier to find one particular point, and that point we're looking for is the original text. If you have at least two, and even three is even better, three witnesses to the possible correct reading. Another point is that some of the readings here in this text prove that when the Septuagint is different from the Masoretic text, that Septuagint was faithfully translating an alternate Hebrew text. People used to think the translator got lazy or he didn't know what he was doing, and now we have actual Hebrew texts that give us what the Septuagint would have been translating. Third, more specifically from this manuscript helps to determine the time when the Samaritan Pentateuch became completely isolated as a textual tradition. We had known before this, through various means, paleography types of readings, that it probably split off sometime around 100 BC, not before that time. But now this text helps to show it must have split off sometime before 30 BC when this text was written, because this text has another major addition, that last column that I showed you. And the Samaritan Pentateuch doesn't have that. So the Samaritan Pentateuch must have split off before that was inserted in this Palestinian tradition. So it transmitted what it had at that time, whereas the Palestinian tradition continued to add at least one more paragraph in its further development. Well, because of the evidence that comes from these scrolls, I've been very happy to work with them, and I'm looking forward to having the results of these scrolls being included in future editions of the text, as it has been in the new edition of a new RSV for the Book of Samuel. Perhaps the same thing will start to happen now with the Book of Numbers. Thank you.
There is time for questions. If anybody has any.
Yes.
Robert Frank, pastor, Alma, Arkansas. A couple of questions. First of all, it must have been a much painstaking work putting those together.
I learned how to use a graph maker on my Mac this weekend.
Was that process computerized where you could put in a couple of characters and the computer would show you what column it might be on, or was that all done by hand?
I started out using graph paper and handwritten reconstructions before I had a computer. After I got a computer, I started putting all of the reconstructions in. And as a result of putting the reconstructions in and using word search and letter search capabilities, we were able to locate another 20 locations or so, very small fragments, that in some cases you can just see from the surroundings. It had to be there, but we couldn't see it before the computer helped locate that. Yeah.
Because I could imagine like part of one word and part of another word, and the concordance
right.
wouldn't show that up.
Right.
Also, when you were describing or comparing the authentic readings versus what was non-authentic or yeah. not be determined, what basis were you making those decisions on?
There are four, those inane rules of modern textual criticism are things that I was using. generally favoring the shorter text, generally favoring the more difficult reading, generally favoring that reading which, if it were original, could by normal scribal errors have produced all the other readings that we have. Those are the three that I use most. There's a fourth one about preferring the better reading, but that didn't come in very often.
I only have a question of clarification. I come from Burlingame, California, and BHS means Burlingame High School.
Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia, the text of the Hebrew Bible that we use.
Right, thank you.